Coming to you live from Haddonfield, Illinois, it's the Hand Plus Podcast brought to you by Movie Changeup. I do that every week, make that mistake. For each week, I, Joseph Ricci, and my co-host Tristan Mayer break down this week in streaming. And this week, it's the spooky season. It's Halloween. We decided to bring on a special guest, friend of the podcast, co-creator of the Movie Changeup podcast, Johnny Dupe, to help us talk about Halloween and the Halloween movies and horror movies in general. We figured who else to bring in to talk about horror movies than someone who knows more about horror movies than I do, because I'm not a big horror movie person. And I'll start with Johnny and ask him the question I usually ask Tristan. First, I'll just say, if you haven't watched our show before, basically we break down this week in streaming all your favorite streaming platforms: HBO Max, Amazon Prime, Netflix, Disney Plus, Hulu, Peacock. If it's a streaming platform and there's a show or movie that we think you should talk about, we think you should be watching, we are going to talk about it. And I will go to Johnny and say, Johnny, how was this week in streaming for you? Did you enjoy your week in streaming? I assumed you mostly stuck to Shudder.
Yeah. I've been only watching horror movies since September 27th. And not only that, I've been watching some, Halloween-themed movies that aren't necessarily horror, like The Addams Family, but I've pretty much been trying to stream a lot of classic horror movies that I haven't seen before. So my week's been very good in terms of that. As far as new things, there was pretty much only one movie that I watched, and we'll talk about it later. I'm excited to see what Tristan thought of it for sure. But as far as new things in streaming, I think it was a weaker week of streaming. But as far as what's available on a lot of stuff in terms of horror movies, I think there's such a great collection of classics and new horror films that people haven't checked out, available across all the different platforms.
All right. And Tristan, kind of same question to you. You feel like it was pretty a light week in streaming, minus some of the kind of stuff that's just been on streaming and some of the older stuff that streaming services just acquired?
Yeah, that's what I'm considering too. We're forgetting some of the stuff that's been on streaming that we kind of take for granted. Like House of the Dragon is still hitting really hard. We're going to talk about She-Hulk and Andor, a couple of ongoing shows that are doing really well right now. But in terms of new drops, yeah, definitely nothing that grab me. Halloween Kills Halloween Ends is technically a streaming drop, so that's going to work for this conversation. But it feels like a theater movie to me anyway, So it feels to me like an off week for streaming this week. I'll say that.
All right. Yeah. I kind of agree with all of you. I went into this week thinking, oh, there's so much to watch, so much great content. And as I was watching it, I just felt like a lot of not good product out there. Pretty much most of what we're going to be talking about is just ongoing shows or basically day and date release movies. So with that, I will kick it off. We're skipping Hulu this week. Honestly, I don't understand why people pay for Hulu if you don't have Hulu Live. Pretty much all their best stuff, I'll be honest, is like their FX crossover stuff. I don't really, they'll have the occasional once a month thing that's worth watching, I guess, but I don't think it's worth just the price of Hulu to watch that show. Like, Prey dropped about a month or two ago, but outside of that, I don't really know the last Hulu original that everyone was talking about, people were hyped about, that was quality content. But so we are just jumping right to Amazon Prime, and I will start the discussion off with The Sound of 007. It's a documentary that came out just this last week on Amazon Prime in honor of them having all 25 Bond movies. And I'm going to be honest, I thought this was a really great documentary. They brought in pretty much every director that's alive from the Bond franchise to come in and talk about the music in their movies. I don't think they have any of the actors other than Daniel Craig. They brought in a lot of the musicians that worked on the music. They talked about how the Bond theme originated, how, like, kind of fun facts, interesting stories from the various Bond songs. And the one that stuck out to me, I remember, was from Diamonds Are Forever. They couldn't crack the song. They couldn't figure out how to do the song, and they essentially just wrote the song as an ode to what they refer to as the male sex organ. They just replaced that term with diamond, and basically that's just kind of how they wrote that song. And another interesting fact from the documentary is Michael Caine was the first ever person to hear the Bond theme, because he was living with the person that wrote the Bond theme at the time, and he was up all night working on it, playing it as he was working on it. So Michael Caine, first person to ever hear the Bond theme outside of its creator, obviously. But yeah, I thought it was really well-made documentary. If you're a fan of kind of behind-the-scenes stuff, behind-the-scenes documentary, or if you're a Bond fan, or if you're a music fan, I would definitely recommend checking out The Sound of 007. It's about an hour and a half long. Very well-made. Worth checking out.
I haven't checked it out yet. I saw it on there, and I almost jumped right into it, but I'm sticking strictly to Halloween/horror movies this month. So I know as soon as I watch that documentary, I will obsessively rewatch all of the Bond movies because I'll get back into my Bond mode. So I'm waiting until post Halloween to check it out. But I am definitely looking forward to it. I love a good documentary behind the scenes and to hear stuff you haven't seen before. There's so many interesting things that have happened behind the scenes in Bond movies and in the Bond franchise. You could make thousands of documentaries on almost every movie in terms of production issues and crazy stories from them. So anything, especially about the music, I'll definitely check it out. So I'm happy to hear that you enjoyed it. Tristan is someone I got you both actually into Bond, but Tristan, are you excited to check that out if you haven't yet?
I have not watched it yet, but I'm going to watch it for sure. Joe's review convinced me, because when I saw it on Amazon Prime, you wonder, is this going to be just some kind of like filler to fill some time and to promote the James Bond stuff? And they have a couple interviews here and there, but it's mostly like archival stuff. But it sounds to me like it's a legit documentary with like a new amount of information to go to my interviews. So yeah, I'm going to check that out for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely a mix of Johnny may know, I'm blanking. I think it's John Barry, right? The guy who composed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he unfortunately passed away in 2011. So you get interviews from him that's all archival, but pretty much I think everyone else is new documentaries. And unlike a lot of the Disney Plus documentary making of stuff, they talk about the bad too. They spend a good amount of time talking about, oh, here's how we made all these good Bond themes. And they're like, but not all the Bond themes are good. And they kind of went into the story on some of the bad ones.
And so, here's Madonna.
Yeah, and I thought that was kind of interesting that they actually acknowledged and touched on the fact that not all of the Bond music, not all of the Bond themes are good, so.
Did they mention that View to a Kill is the best Bond theme? Because that's definitely a contender.
I don't believe they did, no.
Oh, wow. An accurate documentary. Not totally faithful, I think, then. You know,
That's when they do, they have to discuss that because that was the first number one hit of any of the Bond songs, so. I'm sure they do get into that one.
Is that the Duran Duran one? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do talk about... They have Duran Duran on talking about that song.
Oh, so. Wow. Hell, I gotta watch it now.
Yeah, and Jack White talks about his song, and they talk about how that song came to be, how it was supposed to be Amy Winehouse, but she was kind of too far gone at that point, and they had to pivot and change direction. But right, yeah, I don't want to spoil it too much. Definitely worth checking out. And with that... with Amazon Prime, we move over to kind of the season one wrap-up of Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, a show. If you've been watching, I kind of gave up on after about three episodes because I'm like, this isn't for me. It just feels like a remixed version of the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings trilogy, and nothing about it is enticing me and forcing me to watch the next episode. But Tristan kept up with it. Tristan, what are your thoughts on Rings of Power? Should I get back into it? Should people be watching it?
Like you said, you dropped off and I kept up with it. And in the end, I'll say I'm happy I kept up with it. That's my first thought, is even though there were some bumps along the road and I had some questions about the writing and the characters here and there, I do think it was worthwhile for the journey. The production value on the show alone is just so impressive. And the visual scale is just so grand. And you can see the budget on the screen for this movie. Talked about that a bit in the premiere, but that does hold out through the entirety of the season. It's not like they put money into the pilot and then the rest of the season sucks. Like, there's some huge, huge action scenes towards the end that are just really, really well done and really, really well shot. And if you want some spectacle and some action in your fantasy, like if you're watching House of the Dragon and you're like, okay, this is enough talking. I want some like huge, crazy visuals. I want a fantastical fantasy show. This is your fantastical fantasy show. But if you're looking for that kind of political drama, you want to understand the characters, you want to really feel their motivations, and that's what House of the Dragon does kind of offer you, is that alternative of feeling the motivations, feeling that kind of complex drama. And this does not have that. Like, they try to have like some political commentary here and there. They try to have like some dramatic beats here and there, but none of it really plays well. And when they have episodes that try and go into the character arcs deeply, they try to really get into like Galadriel's character arc, and in particular, she's the main character. If you don't know, she was, I don't remember who played it now in the movies, but she was like an elf character in the movies. Lily Taylor played her, I think, in the movies, what her name was. Liv Tyler played her, I think, in the movie.
No, Kate Blanchett played her in the movie.
Kate Blanchett, one of the people in the movie. I started naming actresses until we found the right one. But yeah, this is not connected to the movies and the plot, but it has the same character in it. So it's kind of a prequel. But if you're going to this wanting it to be like a Tolkien prequel or Lord of the Rings prequel directly, it's not going to be that. It's set in the world. It has some of the tying tissue there, but it's not so direct. You know, it's not like the Star Wars prequels. You're seeing Obi-Wan and a bunch of the characters running around. But overall, it's a solid journey for the visual spectacle, but I think the drama and the character motivations and that kind of stuff is what really made this not work overall for people, and what made this not feel like a 5 out of 5 that people were talking about and wanting to see what happens next, you know. And it's hard to not compare it to House of the Dragon because they're competing intentionally so, you know. And House of the Dragon, you think about like some of the most dramatic moments of that show are just character moments, and people are going and talking about online constantly about some of the coolest character beats of House of the Dragon. And this, even in the biggest action beats, you're not really seeing any engagement with that. And I think that's because spectacle and visuals are great, but not when you don't have anything underneath it. And by the end of the season, I felt like I got my worthwhile and visual candy, but in terms of feeling something and learning something and feeling and like kind of understanding the characters, I did not feel like I got that from the show. And it doesn't feel like a lot of people did either. So I'm not quite sure if the show's even going to be coming back for season 2. And if it does, I think it'll be stripped down quite a lot because the budget was huge, huge on this. And I don't think they saw the return they're hoping for of this this king here. So season 2, I'm sure, is along in production already. So if it comes down around, it'll be smaller scale than this. So taking the crazy candy while you can, because it's kind of like a once-in-a-lifetime level spectacle, I think, because we're not going to get this again.
All right. Yeah, I don't know if that review was for me as far as getting me to watch Rings of Power as far as big spectacle. I'm probably just going to stick with House of the Dragon and ride that ship out. But, you know, if season 2 comes like out that, and people are like, this is amazing, I'll go back and watch season 1 to get ready for season 2.
I like that we got these two kind of foils of the same coin, you know, because Lord of the Rings is, this show is much more on the fun side, much more on the kind of adventure side, going and killing cool monsters and that kind of a thing. And Lord of the Rings, I mean, House of the Dragon is much more on the drama side and the not quite selling me on the action side. So it's interesting that we got both of these at the same time because they're both doing kind of opposite things with the same genre. But overall, one is clearly beating the other for me.
Tristan, I'm curious to know. So as someone who hasn't seen either show, the House of Dragons or Rings of Power, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan, but I can't stand the Hobbit movies, and I've never seen Game of Thrones. If I were to start one of these shows, just going in kind of blind, you know, a little more knowledge, obviously, of Lord of the Rings, but what would you recommend to just like a new viewer who hasn't checked either of them out?
I think checking out House of the Dragon will work. There's one particular plot line that ties into the rest of the series, but it's not a prominent plot line, and the fact that it's a prequel helps you not have to know anything that happens. And I honestly feel like this show for Lord of the Rings requires you to know more about what happens than the House of the Dragon does. And I know you do know what happens in Lord of the Rings, but I've seen Lord of the Rings 100 times and I still felt like I didn't totally understand like some of the lore they were pulling and some of the characters they were pulling here. So I felt a little bit lost by the show, even to someone who knows Lord of the Rings. And I think House of the Dragon, Joe might disagree with me on that, but I think House of the Dragon does a decent job of bringing in new people who don't know the plot of Game of Thrones, because there's not any characters or any plot lines that are directly tied to that show.
No, I fully agree with you. I really don't. I don't think you need to know Game of Thrones to understand House of the Dragon. Maybe you'll be a little bit more confused because some of the names and houses and locations, you're not fully grasped, but I don't think you'll be lost because unlike Game of Thrones that focused on like 5 different families, House of the Dragon, you're focused on one family. So.
Okay.
Yeah, both of these throw you into the water a bit, but I think House of the Dragon accomplishes more by the focus, I think, is what really helps that, because you're only on these core characters, and even though the time does jump around and stuff like that, you follow these core characters, and it's a lot easier to follow than Lord of the Rings is.
All right, anything else you got to say on Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, before we move on?
No, I really am curious what the future of this show is, because Amazon invested a lot of money just to get the rights, so I don't imagine this is the last we see of Lord of the Rings on Amazon, but I don't know if we see Rings of Power itself coming back. I think that's it's notable that the title of the show is Lord of the Rings, colon, the Rings of Power. So I could see them doing something like, oh, season two is Lord of the Rings, colon, some other thing, you know, doing a totally different story.
All right. And Johnny, I know you watched the 101 Scariest Horror Movie Moments. I used to, you know, I grew up watching a lot of these type of countdown shows, whether it was like greatest music videos of the 80s or greatest top 10 movie moments. So is this, how good is this? Is this something people should be watching?
So like you, when I was a kid, I was a sucker for, you know, VH1s. It could be anything. Top 100 toys, top 100, music videos, the most shocking moments in music. And I always watched those, and I always liked hearing kind of more behind the scenes stories of them. So when you tie a very similar concept to movies that I love, or a, you know, just a genre in general that I love, it's really, really cool. And you'd think too, okay, it's a Shudder original. It's basically one, they show a movie scene, you know, and they cut to the talking heads talking about it. You wouldn't think they get very big names, but you have people like Mike Flanagan, you have people like Fede Alvarez, you get real horror movie directors, and you get, you know, Howard Berger, who did a lot of makeup and special effects for all these classic horror films. You get to talk about, you know, they show a scene from Friday the 13th and cut to Howard Berger telling you how they made that scene. I love it. It's giving me a lot of movies, anything that I haven't seen, I'm adding to my watch list. And movies that they are talking about, they could be movies that I've seen dozens of times, like Misery. I've never looked at that and really thought about, okay, how do they do the scene where they break his legs? You know, James Caan and Kathy Bates in that scene, you know.
Wow.
But that's the scene everyone knows, right? So, like, you can go into a famous scene and you think, like, oh, a countdown show, if it's something I've seen, it might be kind of boring. The stuff that I was super interested in are scenes that I've seen more often, and they cut to the makeup artist who worked on it, and they're talking about how they made that happen. They're talking about how they used cast of his legs and used a real sledgehammer because Rob Reiner wanted it to look like Kathy Bates was putting force into it, you know? So stuff like that, I love that insight into it. So it's really interesting. If you're a horror fan, which I think you need to be to really check this out, or you have to just be able to stomach gore, because they don't cut anything out. They show full scenes. They show the violent moments. They show those things, especially because a lot of it is focused on talking about practical effects, talking about why the director made this choice, talking about how they it affected them as an audience member. I think that stuff really works, and obviously it is on Shudder, which you probably don't have if you're not a horror fan. So if you do have it, I mainly just check out movies, but this is a really fun show to just go watch. They do about, I think, 13 episodes at a time. New episodes are every Wednesday night, so I'm excited to check the new one out. And this is less of a countdown of, you're not going to get mad at, oh, well, it's bullshit that, you know, Psycho is number 80 and Don't Breathe is number 30. This is more tying things together in terms of, they will do, you know, a movie where something similar happens. They will talk about the Blair Witch Project and then go immediately into Paranormal Activity. Mm-hmm. So they'll transition closer to, that's kind of how the list is separated, to do it rather than like a ranking. It's okay. More of, this is just 101 great moments, and it has good, you know, similar ones to each other. So you get insight into, this is how Blair Witch Project worked. This is how they, you know, worked with that same found footage stuff 10 years later. So I like the establishment of the list, and it's not something that you'll watch and just be like, this is bullshit because this movie is 80 and this movie is 30. Like, that's not what the show is about. It's just getting really cool insight and behind the scenes stuff from people who worked on movies or just fans of movies. And I think even it can help change the perspective of how you watch a lot of different horror movies, because, you know, if you get Joe Dante talking about the Howling, maybe you go into that movie and you're like, this isn't very scary. But then you get Joe Dante talking about how they made it, and you get someone who saw it in 1981 when it came out, and kind of see how they felt about it and do it. You kind of look for new things with horror films. So I think a lot of this stuff, because I'm not afraid of anything in horror movies, but I like watching it for the atmosphere that it builds, the practical effects in a lot of the old films. So it's cool to see people that watch it in similar ways or in completely different ways than you've seen scenes, then you see them a different way going forward. So highly recommend if you're a movie fan, and if you can stomach the gore and the violence of some of the scenes that they do go through and show, I think it's a show for most people that would really enjoy it. Joe, I think you'd like it because you like talking about the sound of 007. It's a similar type of setup, but it's more of a countdown rather than just, you know, behind the scenes stuff. And Tristan, you'd be all about it. You'd be obsessed with this.
I definitely need to watch it. I've been wanting to see it. I see it on Shudder, and yeah, like I said, probably kind of in the last one, you don't necessarily know how deep is going to go. Are they going to be like deep cut good horror moments? Are they going to be like, oh, this scene where Michael Myers shows up, or in the scene where this, like all the mainstream scenes? And it sounds to me like they do a good mix. Like, you're going to have stuff from the obvious picks in there, because those are the ones, you know, and you do want to get those in there. You know, you want to see, like, how do they stab Kevin Bacon's neck in Friday the 13th and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But you also want to get some of the more interesting ones, ones like The Howling, where maybe you haven't seen it, but it inspires you to go and watch the movie because you see that one moment and you kind of get an appreciation for the craft of it. So, yeah, that's something I love about horror as a genre, just the craft and the practical effects, and kind of like people will be grossed out by gore and the kills and that kind of a thing. But for me, it's less about the deaths, and a lot of it's about like, how do they make that look like that, and how good does it look? How real does it look? And what kind of like practical personal effort went into making that death look so good, you know? And that's what I love about those old classic horror movies. So it feels like I'm gonna get a lot out of the show. I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, the other fun thing with it too is it doesn't just stick to like the deep cut thing you were talking about. It doesn't just stick to horror movies in general, like as a whole. Like they've talked about moments from Seven and Zodiac, and they've even brought in moments from Haunting of Hill House, which is obviously because, you know, Mike Flanagan is on there. But they'll switch it up and they'll talk about maybe scary scenes from movies that aren't necessarily a horror movie. So I like seeing that too, because it's like typically you watch, oh, the 100 greatest horror movies of all time, and you don't see some of these films included. But seeing that perspective on other movies that just have maybe one or two horrific scenes in it, and you still get to tie that in with, you know, the reveal of Frankenstein from 1931, and then you're talking about, you know, the sloth scene in Seven or something like that. Like it's a really fun mix, and they do a good job transitioning to something similar or just going way off the board and changing things up. They talked about I Saw the Devil, which is one of my favorite movies. So like they are bringing in movies that maybe people wouldn't expect to see on a list like this. You'd go in, like you said, oh, the Friday the 13th scene. They're just going to talk about Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween and Saw and all these movies that we've seen before. But they do a great job bringing in movies that you probably, even as a huge movie fan, that I've never even heard of before, that I've added to my watch list. So it's definitely a fun watch around Halloween. It'll give you ideas if you're like me and just want to watch as many horror movies as you can throughout the spooky season.
All right. Any more?
So I watch this for sure.
All right. And sticking with Shudder, Tristan, I believe you watched Mad God on Shudder as well, if you want to give us just a very quick review.
Yeah, I was super excited for this one. It's on my list for the anticipated movies of this year. And it came out, I think, last year, honestly. But it's been kind of like shuffling out through festivals. And if you don't know, this is definitely a smaller release. It's created and directed kind of the passion project of Phil Tippett, who was a founding member of ILM. He worked on Star Wars trilogy, Jurassic Park, RoboCop, a lot of those classic, iconic practical effects, sci-fi and horror movies back in the day. And this was his passion project. He worked on this for years and years and actually funded it through Kickstarter and did kind of like an online funding campaign for it. And he finally got it released on Shudder just this summer. And if you don't know, this is kind of, it's a stop motion horror movie. So it's from the guy who did ILM work. So he's an expert of practical effects and spent years and years making this meticulously crafted stop motion horror movie. And it's very meticulously crafted. I think it's gorgeous. Is that, and like, it just looks so, every frame is just filled with so much stuff. And you see all these different new creatures and these terrifying new designs and new locations. And I had a great time watching this. There's not necessarily a great plot line. Like, you're just following this kind of assassin traveling through the underworld, but you're kind of getting these crazy hell sequences and all these different visuals. And it's very cool to see somebody who worked on my childhood movies like Star Wars and Jurassic Park getting to like unleash his dark side and make this really horrifying, bloody, insane mess. Yeah, it's on Shudder. It's a pretty short watch, and definitely if you want to get some crazy visuals, see stuff you've never seen before in a horror movie, check this one out. It's very bizarre and very gonzo. I know Johnny also watched it, I believe. So if you have any thoughts on it, Johnny, I'd love to hear what you thought too.
So I started watching it today. I made it about halfway through. I'm super into it so far. I just had a busy day, so I'm going to finish that tonight when we're done podcasting. But yeah, it's, Phil Tippett is the man who made T-Rexes real to you as a child. He brought that to life. He designed and built Jabba the Hutt. So like, he is the guy behind a lot of these super famous creatures and scenes. So like Tristan said, this so far, at least for me, I agree. It's, you know, it's not a movie you watch for plot. It's a movie you watch. And what I love about it is it feels like you're watching going through a like a haunted house, like the most fucked up haunted house you'll ever go through. Basically someone who has worked on this project for 20 years, and you go through and you just see all this insane stop motion stuff. You're used to seeing like Wallace and Gromit and things like that. This is not like any stop motion you've seen before. It's really creative and unique. And yeah, it's just, it's like experiencing watching, you know, a haunted house. That's what I really like the vibe of it so far. So I'm excited to finish it. And I'm expecting it not to be too different than how it started, but every scene, I can't wait to see the new creatures and designs, and even just the sound design is really, really awesome in it. So it's definitely something that you would watch just to appreciate effects like that rather than watching it for like a narrative story. But it totally works for me as someone who's a big fan of that stuff.
Yeah, and I'll say it's crazy and cool and gonzo with the effects and the visuals, but I wouldn't call it scary. So if you're someone who's like, I don't want to be scared, I don't want to see like gore and like people getting mutilated, it's not that kind of a movie. It's pretty intense sometimes on like the craziness of the visuals, but I wouldn't say it's going to be like, you know, terrifying in that way. It's not like a gore fest. It's not like a Terrifier 2 type situation.
All right, and keep it rolling with Amazon Prime. If no one else has anything to say about Mad God, I'll say we got a little bit of news this morning. We got the poster release for Creed 3, and it looks like it may be a day and date release on Amazon Prime, so I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Interesting.
Just because like Prime Video tweeted out the poster, so it may be a day and date release of March 3rd, 2023. So looking forward to that. I love the first Creed. Thought the second Creed was decent. And this will be Michael B. Jordan's directorial debut. So he's starring and directing Creed 3. And we also have some upcoming Doctor Who news, Tristan, if you want to talk about that real quick.
Oh, yeah. Doctor Who, I didn't know this until recently, but they actually do day and date release their episodes on AMC Plus. So if you want to watch this in a couple of, I think a week from today, or maybe a week from yesterday, the final episode of Jodie Whittaker's run as Doctor Who. If you don't know, she was the first woman to take over the role of Doctor Who on the show, and she's going to be regenerating this episode into whoever the next Doctor is going to be, and setting up what is going to be the 60th anniversary special of Doctor Who coming up next year. So they're going to be, usually for these anniversaries, they bring back a lot of the old Doctors, a lot of the old characters. So I would expect to see some old faces showing up this episode, kind of setting that up, that big kind of anniversary special up, and plus get to say goodbye to a really interesting, pivotal historical take on the character. So I'm going to be watching it for sure. And even though I'm not as connected to the show as I was when I was in like high school, it's going to be cool to see these transitional moments. It feels kind of like, you know, getting back in touch with my youth a little bit to see the turning of the key here to the TARDIS over to whoever. Oh, we know who's taking it over next, but I have a bit of a pet theory that we might see a surprise face at the end of the episode. So if you're nostalgic for the olden days of the show, you might want to watch the episode here and get some nostalgia with me.
All right. Never seen an episode of Doctor Who, but if you're a Doctor Who fan, check that out. And with that, we move on to Netflix and our sole topic. Tristan, I believe you finished season one of The Midnight Club.
I did. I know you started it last week. You only watched, I think, the first two episodes and then handed it off to me. And I was happy to take it off. And yeah, I agree with you on the first two episodes. I was really happy with that. And I was also nervous to go into the rest of the season because the first two episodes were the only ones, I believe, that Mike Flanagan himself directed. And then he handed it off to other people. And this was the first time he's, I believe, done that in some of these shows. Usually it's kind of like his personal individual creation, especially in the last one that was like he wrote this and built this from the ground up. It was kind of his baby. And this was not that. I liked this a lot, though. It wasn't necessarily as intense and scary and dramatic as more of Mike Flanagan's hands-on work, but I really enjoyed this. And I think the premise, if you don't know, is if you didn't watch last week, the premise of the show is it's a kids at a hospice center. It's sort of like an X-Men-style mansion that is taking on these kids as to hospice who are dying. And we follow this main character who's been having dreams of the hospital and having kind of these strange visions of what she thinks is kind of the hospital's past or something like that. And then she goes to this hospital for that reason and tries to uncover the mystery of this hospital, the patients there, and what connects all of them through their kind of trauma and their shared fate, you know? So I really enjoy this. I don't want to get into any spoilers, because if you have watched any of the other Mike Flanagan stuff, you know that a lot of them do have a lot of good plot pulls and twists and kind of building up the mystery, and watching that mystery unravel is a lot of the fun of these shows. So if you've liked the previous stuff, you'll probably like this. It's not necessarily as compelling as the rest of them, but it's still really, really good. And I enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed a lot of the plot twists, and they tell some kind of interesting stories, because the premise is that they gather together at midnight to tell horror stories to each other. And when they're telling these stories, they'll cut away and kind of show these stories into their full production value, sort of. And it, some of those short stories are really, really cool. So if you're a fan of reading those old kind of short story horror books back in the day, I read a good amount of those, and this feels kind of like that. You know, you're reading these quick little stories, and then you also have this Mike Flanagan style, like ancient historical mystery backing it all up. So I really enjoyed it a lot, and I recommend it, especially now that we're getting into the horror week, especially you're getting towards the end of the month. I think this is a great binge for people who are sitting around looking for something to watch on Netflix. They feel like they've seen the horror classics before, they don't really know what to watch, and now they want to throw on maybe a show. This is definitely one to watch. And if you haven't watched the rest of the Mike Flanagan stuff, this might actually be a pretty good place to start, because it's a bit of an easier watch and might kind of warm me up a bit to the structure and the Flanagan monologues and all the talking. So it'll get you ready for the really prime Flanagan's to meet you later.
All right, yeah. Johnny, have you watched any of Mike Flanagan's Netflix shows? You're muted.
I am muted. So I've seen Flanagan shows. My favorite was Midnight Mass.
Okay.
Of the three, but I really enjoyed all of them. And I'm a huge fan of all the movies he's done too. So that's, you know, something like I was saying with the scariest films list on Shudder, he's on there, and you get to see some moments from his movies and his shows and hear some insight from him. So I'm excited to see anything he's done. Like Tristan was saying, I was a little skeptical going into this one. The only reason I haven't watched it yet is because I know he only did two episodes of it and then handed it off. So I didn't know if it would be as good as his other projects, but I'm excited to see, you know, Tristan was into it. You were into the first two episodes I heard last week. So I'll definitely check this one out. Anything Flanagan's behind at this point, I'll definitely see. They just announced his cast list for his next show, which I think is the House of the Usher. So they tweeted that out, and you get a lot of his regulars. You get your, you know, Raul Collies and things like that. So I'm assuming this show is also going to be on Netflix, and you get to see him work with a couple new people in it. So you get Mark Hamill and Bruce Greenwood and some people he hasn't worked with, and then the typical cast of characters that he always does. So anything he does, I will eventually watch, even if I'm not right on board with it. But over quarantine is when I pretty much caught up with all his shows. And then when Midnight Mass came out, I watched that. So yeah, I'll definitely check this one out.
And he actually has worked with Bruce Greenwood, because he was in Gerald's Game with that.
True.
Flanagan directed. So with that, I think we move on from Netflix. Pretty light week from Netflix this week. And we move on to Disney Plus, and let's kick it off with season one review of She-Hulk, Attorney at Law. So if you haven't watched the show, She-Hulk is Jennifer Walters, Bruce Banner's cousin, and they're Bruce Banner, Jennifer Walters hanging out together, having a good time. They get in a car accident, and she starts losing blood, and her cousin gives her a blood transfusion, and that gives her the power of She-Hulk. And if you don't know the comics very well, I didn't really before the show started. I kind of found out some about it as the show went on. Very much about breaking the fourth wall, just like Deadpool. And the show very much kept that. She talks directly to the audience, references the fact that it's a show on Disney Plus. I wasn't sure when it first started. I watched, like, if you've been watching our show, you know I've watched like the first two or three episodes and then kind of dipped out. And this last Saturday, after the finale, I went and I binge watched the rest of the season. I'll be honest, I really, really liked it. I think it kind of broke a little bit away from the Marvel formula, which is the thing I was most excited about, especially with that finale. I don't want to talk too much about the finale and spoil it if you haven't watched it. Finale was a little wild, I'll say that. Right. And I think if you, I really don't think you, if you were kind of like a fan of the MCU, but you're like, oh, it's just too formulaic and predictable and kind of dipped out, I think you can jump back in and watch this. I really don't think there's anything you needed to really know of beforehand coming into this, especially if you've just watched like all the main Avengers movies. I think you're pretty much caught up. But Tristan, I'll let you talk about it real quick, because I know you binge watched it very recently as well.
Yeah, we were in a similar position because we only watched the first couple episodes. Zai and I fell off. A lot of other stuff came on. You know, House of the Dragon was really capturing my attention, and then She-Hulk fell off the list for me, you know. And then I saw the finale was coming up, and we said, hey, let's do a binge. You know, and I'm not going to lie, what kind of convinced me to binge it was that I'd seen a couple of the screenshots from the finale and clips from the finale surfacing up on Twitter as soon as it aired, and I thought, oh, they really went wild with the finale. I got to check out the show. I think I'm going to go ahead and give it a watch, and it's definitely worth your time. You can watch this whole season in like a single day if you want to, and maybe 2 days if you're like a normal person who like will take some time between your episodes. But yeah, pretty short binge, and I liked it a lot. I think it gets better as it goes along. I think the first couple episodes that we watched and reviewed are a little bit weak and a little bit confused, and then as they get more into the fourth wall breaking, as they get more into Jen having fun and balancing the kind of weirdest of the world, it gets a lot more interesting. I think there's a highlight episode where she has to work with Wong from Doctor Strange, and he's suing a magician in our normal world because he stole some of their magic and is using it in this like hokey magician show. And you get kind of like a fun Marvel world lawyer situations like that too. I think that's kind of the fun of the show. You're getting She-Hulk thrown into these weird situations where she has to not only be a Hulk but be a lawyer and kind of balance both of those worlds. And I think balancing both of those worlds is where She-Hulk the show struggles the most, much like the character, because I think when the show is having fun and enjoying itself and doing the meta commentary and the fun and letting, especially when it's letting Jen do her thing, it's a great show. But I think some of the drama stuff, a lot of the legal stuff didn't work well for me. I think when they try to actually make legal arguments, it feels like a CW show. It feels almost very terrible at points. Like there's certain scenes where in the courtroom and they're making arguments and I'm thinking like, did you even try to watch like Law and Order or anything like that? You know, I know the writers said in interviews that they didn't do a lot of courtroom scenes because they realized as they were writing it that they're not actually that great at writing courtroom stuff. And I thought when I read that headline, maybe you shouldn't have like done a lawyer show if you can't write courtroom dialogue well. Like that should be kind of a prerequisite. But I enjoy this overall. I'm not as high on it as Joe is, but I think when it's having fun, it's really fun. When it's trying to be serious, it is not necessarily working, and it feels kind of like a bit of a mess. I know that the show got edited around a bit, and a lot of plot points got moved around, and plot points got deleted. Characters got deleted who were going to be in the finale that were not in the finale. So another one of those Marvel snipping the thing around at the last second to try and get it to fit in the right hole type situation. So a curious mix of a season that I'm positive on, not as positive as Joe, but I really, really liked a lot of it. I wasn't huge on the rest of it, but it's definitely worth a watch, especially if you're tired of the formula for Marvel and you want to break away a bit and see some weirdness.
Yeah, I could sign that. Johnny, is She-Hulk anything that interests you at all, or are you just like, I don't care?
I watched the first like three Marvel shows on Disney Plus, got to Loki, and outside of like a couple moments, I wasn't into it, and I just gave up on all the Disney Plus Marvel shows. So I'm interested to maybe one day check out just all the shows in like a week time and just check out everything I've missed. But until I do that, yeah, I probably won't check out She-Hulk. I've heard some interesting things. I've heard some good stuff here and there, but as a series, none of them have really worked for me. So I kind of was just out on everything Marvel's done TV wise. They got to have another really great movie to kind of bring me into liking the MCU again, because I feel like everything they've done, I really enjoyed Shang-Chi, but everything that has come out after that And even some of the stuff around that, I haven't really cared for. So it'll be interesting. They got to sell me again on their movies before I'm into their TV shows.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. And with that, we're going to do a little wrap up of the last arc of Andor. What I originally thought, I guess, was that they were going to do 3-episode arcs, but then Tony Gilroy or Dan Gilroy or one of the kind of guys behind the scenes of the show was like, yeah, so the first 3 episodes were an arc. Four, five, and six were an arc. Episode 7 kind of stands alone and is its own thing. And then 8, 9, and 10 are an arc. And then 11 and 12 are the finale. So originally we were just going to do a wrap up after every arc and talk about that. But I don't know how we're going to do it from here on out. We'll just figure it out as we go.
That's more a midway point review, you know, our midpoint recap of Andor.
Yeah, so with that, Tristan, it's a very serious take on Star Wars without being like, it definitely acknowledges the goofy side of Star Wars, especially with kind of towards the ending of the last episode, episode 6. And, but it's serious without being like just graphic or violent for violence sake or just swearing for swearing sake. It just feels like, what if HBO made Star Wars? Is essentially mm-hmm. how I would break it down. The plot of this recent episode, the episode 3 ended, the end of the last arc with Luthen Rail hiring Cassian Andor to do a job for him. I need you to do a job. And these last 3 episodes were kind of the setup for the job, the planning of the job, and then the final episode was the execution of the job, where they are going to steal the payroll from the Empire on this planet. And you got a lot of kind of modern politics in there, especially talking about immigration and kind of the colonial government's thoughts of indigenous people. And this definitely takes a political stance, and in a show that's dealing directly with war and boots on the ground and spying and espionage, something that it'd be odd if they didn't bring in politics. But I really liked it. It's hard for me to say, like, oh, this is my favorite Star Wars show, especially live action, because I can look at it and be like, oh, this is well made, this is great, this is amazing. If someone said, oh, this is my favorite Star Wars thing ever, I couldn't say that they're wrong or I wouldn't think they were weird. It's just not exactly what I come to Star Wars for. I come more for, like, the goofy and weird and the lightsabers. But if you watch Rogue One and you're like, my favorite parts were, like, this kind of action espionage boots on the ground, then I think if you haven't checked out Andor, you definitely should. But Tristan, I'll get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, Johnny mentioned that Marvel has to win him back by having actual good movies for him, and I'm in the same boat for Star Wars. Star Wars had me so checked out. Not good movies, not good TV shows. I mean, I love The Last Jedi, but that was probably the last Star Wars thing I could say that I genuinely loved. Until this, I'm loving Andor. I think it's great. I think it's a totally different take on Star Wars. It's definitely a spy thriller. It's like a boots on the ground espionage show, and a lot of times they'll claim that, you know, let's say, oh, She-Hulk is a lawyer show, and then it's not really a lawyer show. She does lawyer stuff in it, but it's not a lawyer show. And or they'll say, oh, Captain America Winter Soldier, that's a spy thriller, and it's like not really. It's still kind of just a Marvel movie with like a spy kind of sheen to it. And this feels like a spy thriller that's just set in the Star Wars universe. You know, it's like taking your Star Wars toys and doing a spy show with them. Yeah, and I really am enjoying that a lot. And it doesn't have any of the fan service type of stuff. Nobody's saying, you know, the iconic lines. No one's saying, oh, I got a bad feeling about this. You haven't even seen like Stormtroopers or Darth Vader or any of the big iconic Star Wars, you know, images. You might not see any of that in this show at this point. And I love that. I think it's a new perspective, and it shows that you don't necessarily have to also get like 1,000 years in the past or way removed from what we know to have a new story with new characters and a new perspective. You can make a spinoff about a character from a spinoff and have it still be good. And I'm really impressed by this. It's the most I've liked Star Wars in years. And I really hope that this is a sign for the future. I don't know how the viewership is doing. I have a feeling it's not going to be hitting as hard as some of the other Star Wars shows did, but in a way, I think that's a fault of their own, because they are coming off of a couple of weak Star Wars shows in a row that people probably saw this and thought, oh, it's going to be another like shot for home video quality, like Disney Channel series, like the last two have been, so I'm not going to watch it. And this is better than anything Disney's done with Star Wars in a really, really, really long time. I'm loving it. And yeah, it's political because Star Wars has been political since the beginning.
Yeah.
So don't be surprised when suddenly there's a political commentary in Star Wars. So the first movie was political in 1977. So don't be shocked now.
Yeah. All right. And Johnny, I'll pose the same question to you I asked after She-Hulk. Does Andor interest you at all? Does our review, does our thoughts change anything? Is this something you've seen reactions to online and wanted to check out? Or are you just like, I don't care?
I think this is one that I'll probably check out before any of the Marvel shows, because you two saying how good it is, especially Tristan raving about it, when I know his feelings and a lot of the Disney stuff, I feel very similar to that with Star Wars. So I think I'll check this one out. I like Andor as a character, and I'm excited to see it. I think my problem with a lot of the Star Wars stuff is similar to what Marvel is doing now of, oh, to understand this character, to understand this plot point, you would have had to seen this animated show from 10 years ago or whatever. And like, I think Book of Boba Fett had a lot of that, and I super wasn't into that show, but I liked Mandalorian seasons 1 and 2 just fine. I think that had some episodes that were better than others, but I thought Book of Boba Fett was pretty much terrible.
Yeah.
I wasn't like rushing in to see any new Star Wars show, but I think from everything that I've seen online and from what you two have said about Andor, I'm going to check this one out. I might wait until the whole thing completes and then stream it all in like one day. Or I might check it out sooner, because I watched even Book of Boba Fett, which I wasn't into. I actually watched that week to week. So this one, if I get into it, I think I'll be into it. And it sounds like something cool and new that they're going a new direction for it, which I like. And I've been saying Star Wars needs to do forever instead of just making the same movies over and over again. So, I mean, I'm someone who, as far as my love for Star Wars, I have nostalgia for it. I love the first 3 movies, and I honestly don't think they've made anything that decent even since then. I don't care about the prequels. I don't care about the any of the movies in the Disney series. So I like some stuff here and there, but if this is like a legitimately good Star Wars show, it will pique nostalgia, and I love the universe, so I'm excited to see something good that's actually done with it since, the 80s.
Yeah, and Tristan, I'm not wrong in saying I feel like there's only, so far, 2 characters from previous properties in Andor, and Cassian Andor and Mon Mothma. I don't think there's anyone else that we've seen yet that's been in anything else, right?
No, and I don't think you have to even... Like, Rogue One will give you some nice emotional context, but I don't think you even have to have seen that to see this show.
Yeah, Tristan and I were talking. I don't remember if it was on air or off air, or maybe it was just texting. I don't remember, but we were like, what's, like, the ideal order to show someone Star Wars? And we thought it'd be interesting. If Andor is good and it holds up quality, if you were showing, like, a kid, well, probably not a kid, but if, like, someone that's never seen Star Wars before, you show them Andor first, then you show them Rogue One, and then you show them Star Wars A New Hope. I think that could be an interesting way to show someone Star Wars. I really have not seen anything that's like, if you're watching this without anything else, that you'd be lost.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how it wraps up. We're only halfway through the season, and I'm really impressed by it, but I do know Disney Plus does have a tendency to sometimes drop the ball at the last second, so yeah. I'm not getting my hopes up super high yet, because we'll get ourselves all excited and then they'll come out and they'll do another dick joke on us at the last second,
I will say I think a lot of that problem though is they are spending too much time trying to set new things up, where I feel like Andor isn't really that. The thing they would be setting up is already out, and it came out in 2016, so I feel like they're not having to waste time and energy trying to set up the next thing, because it's really its own standalone thing, and anything it's set up, like I said, already came out. So hopefully it will allow it to end strong, because they basically said that it's going to end right before Rogue One starts. So,
yeah, and I feel like this show doesn't have any interest in super connecting stuff. Like, you might see a 1 or 2 Rogue One characters show up at the end or something like that. You might see the droid from Rogue One show up in the last episode or something, but I don't necessarily see them doing, oh, here's like Luke Skywalker in this scene. It's going to be very much its own thing.
With that, I don't have anything to say about Andor, but to wrap up Disney Plus and Disney Plus news, it looks like Harrison Ford has signed on to replace William Hurt as Thunderbolt Ross, so he will be taking over for the Thunderbolt show, and then I guess his first appearance will be in Captain America 4 New World Order.
That's an interesting casting. I don't want you to forget something, though, that Johnny did watch. He he suffered through something for us, you know?
Oh yeah, you did. I forgot about that. It's not on the sidebar, but it is in the notes. Johnny, you did watch New Mutants. I have not and will not watch it. I don't know about Tristan's experience with New Mutants, but let us hear it.
So this is something, you know, I haven't been on this show yet in terms of the Hand Plus, so I had to do what you guys have done previously, both of you, and suffered through something for the sake of the show. So Joe said, well, who wants to bite the bullet and check out New Mutants? And I said, you know what? That falls under the category of horror, you know, at least on IMDb. Did you think- so I'll check it out. And, man, I got to say, it's just a waste of time. It's an hour and a half long, and it feels way longer. There's nothing that I can point to in it and say, like, okay, this is actively terrible. But I just wasn't into it from the start. It's something that felt like, I know there was a bunch of, you know, studio delays and rewrites and everything behind it. But you feel that during the movie. But I can't even look at it and be like, oh, they had something there. You know, they try to do a horror movie, but they introduce a new team of characters. So you know nothing's going to happen to them. It's like making the first Avengers movie, but making it a horror movie. The worst thing a horror movie can have is having no stakes. And that's what this has. You know, nothing's happening to at least most of these characters. They're all making it through to the end. So when you have your lead in a superhero movie be the one that's in danger, you know that nothing's actually going to happen. So there's no actual sense of tension or drama built through that. I thought they have a really fun cast, so maybe they'll sell me, but I don't know if they just weren't into it. They knew they were kind of working with nothing. But the funniest part of it, honestly, the only thing that I did get enjoyment out, Charlie Heaton from, or Charlie Heston or whatever the hell his name is from Stranger Things, in a couple scenes, he has a really deep Southern accent. And then every other scene, there's no accent. So it's really funny watching that because every time that he had an accent, it caught me off guard. And I was like, oh, shit, that's right. He's supposed to have an accent. So I got some fun out of that. But it literally felt like they filmed two different movies and they put them together. And every other scene felt different than the last because some scenes characters talk like they did in the last scene. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes things have a horror overtone. Sometimes they don't. There are a couple things they could have done a little better for it. But based on what they actually gave us, this felt like the end of the Fox X-Men run, and you don't want that in a movie where you're supposed to be introducing new mutants, new characters, and the whole movie just felt like the downfall of the Fox X-Men franchise, which, if you look at it as a whole, is one of the most inconsistent and most bizarre things to figure out in terms of any franchise, because I don't know if you can point to any other movie franchise in history where it has such high highs and such low lows. But this is definitely one of the low lows. So I checked this out just for this show, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. If you're a completionist on the X-Men franchise, which I'm not even, I'll never watch whatever the last actual X-Men one was.
Dark Phoenix, I believe it was.
Phoenix, not going to check that out. This was on a never care about, never watch, but I was like, whatever. And the only thing that ever was good about this was maybe the first trailer that was ever released, but it was doomed ever since they pushed it back originally.
Probably will watch this. I'm a bit of a completionist for the X-Men, I won't lie. I've seen all the movies a handful of times, and even the real big duds like Origins Wolverine, I've seen a good amount of times because I just like, well, I'm watching the franchise, I'm not gonna just skip one, you know. I might as well just watch this one, so I might as well cap it off, you know. I might as well pour out a couple of drinks and get myself through the finale of the Fox X-Men universe before Marvel comes in and, you know, beats the corpse to death, you know?
Yeah, I honestly, with this, my biggest problem was it wasn't bad enough to be fun and it wasn't good enough to, you know, do anything for you. So if it was like, if it had a lot of bad cringeworthy moments, I think I would have gotten more out of it. But it's just so bland and so bleak and every scene just feels dead upon arrival that it was just, you know, it was just kind of a boring watch. It was a huge dud. I could go back and watch X-Men Origins Wolverine and at least laugh at how bad some of the stuff is in it, but this doesn't even have that. So it doesn't even give you the so bad it's good type of stuff. It's just like,
dang,
here's this really bland 90 minutes, and that's all you're getting.
Yeah, I'm definitely never going to watch that, but it is crazy how it seems like other than the first X-Men movie, there's no, like, fine X-Men movies. It seems like all of the movies in that franchise are either great or horrible. There's hardly any, like, oh, that one's, like, okay, I guess.
Yeah, there's not many in-betweens. It's either very good or very bad, and I don't know if there's another franchise where you can say has so many movies that fall into those categories. There's some that have a few very good and a few very bad, you know, or just a shit ton of, and then the rest are like a shit ton of in between. Like, that's how I'd say Star Wars is. But like X-Men as a franchise with Fox is, if you go to watch a good one, you're getting something great. Days of Future Past, one of the greatest comic book movies ever made. And then you go and you watch Apocalypse and you're like, this is awful. Like, how is this the follow-up? Like, it's just baffling. So this one, just going into it, knowing that it probably wasn't going to be good, but excited about the cast, and then you don't get much out of the cast. It was just like, man, I wish at least they took more chances, and they don't.
Yeah. All right, and I think that does actually wrap up Disney Plus, and we will be moving on to Peacock, I believe, where Tristan and Johnny both watched Halloween Ends. I did not. I have not even seen Halloween Kills. Will I? Also no.
You should. Great movie, though. Great movie.
Tristan was all with me about this movie, then rewatched it in probably an inebriated state, and now he says that Halloween Kills is good, and I can't get behind it. I can't.
We've got Halloween Ends to talk about today, though. Halloween Ends, you know, supposedly the finale of the Halloween franchise, definitely the finale of this trilogy. They make a definitive end to it for sure, but I don't know what. It's hard to summarize the plot because they do pull a bit of a rug out from you on this movie in a way that we'll talk about. But I think our spoiler policy is we don't talk about who lives or who dies, but we got to talk about the shift in focus, I think, because if you go into this based on the trailers and the poster and you're looking for the Michael Myers versus Laurie Strode finale, you're looking for that final battle, that final fight, you're not really going to get that here. Like, you're going to get the fight. You saw it in the trailer, so you know it's in the movie there. But Michael Myers is not necessarily the focus. Laurie Strode is not necessarily the focus of this movie. They bring in a new character called Corey Cunningham, who experiences a really traumatic event on Halloween night in the opening sequence. A really, really, I think, effective opening sequence that set the movie up for something interesting, a unique take on the franchise. Johnny talked about in the last review, a franchise that needs to have some swings, and I think this opening sequence established a bit of a big swing for the franchise, especially to focus on a different character like this. And they in particular focus on the relationship between Corey and Allison, who's Jamie Lee Curtis's granddaughter in this movie. And they kind of form a bit of a romantic bond over the fact that they have the shared trauma, and it's following their romantic endeavors while alongside them, Michael Myers is kind of rising up from the ashes of Halloween Kills and hoping to maybe get his final revenge on Laurie Strode. So, Johnny, I want to get your thoughts on this first, because I know I am a more positive on it than you are. So, I think I'd like to hear you roast it for a second, and then I can come in and maybe give a little bit of a defense.
My biggest takeaway from this is, if you took Halloween Ends and you took Halloween Kills, and you switched a couple of plot points and you gave Halloween Kills the ending of Halloween Ends rather than how it ended, and you switched the order of how they came out, you put this movie second and you put Halloween Kills third, I think this franchise as a whole, this trilogy, works a little better. It works smoother. My biggest issue with this is that, yes, it's okay to try something new with a horror franchise. You know, you can't always have the same formula. It can't always be Michael going to kill Laurie on Halloween. It can't always be that. The problem with this one is, this is called Halloween Ends. This is supposed to be the finale of your trilogy that you have set up. Laurie's back. It's Laurie versus Michael. It's, you know, 40 years later. It's the final showdown. And you get 10 minutes of it, you know, and they showed most of it in the trailer. So my biggest thing with it is, even if what they had done with this movie was interesting, which I didn't think anything they tried was, I didn't care about the characters, I didn't care about the new character, I thought the actor was bad, and I thought the actual plot line they were going for was really bad. But outside of that, even if they nailed that stuff, this is a really, really poor finale to your trilogy, because you don't get what you came in here for. This whole movie, they could have just done an hour and 45 minute fight between Laurie and Michael, and it could have been the most ridiculous, stupid thing ever. It would have worked better than this as a finale to the three films. You know, after I like 2018, it's fun. It is a throwback. It does the same formula like we talked about, but I think Joe has similar feelings where if they just never made another Halloween movie after 2018 Halloween, yeah, I think that's more highly regarded, because they're like, oh, they killed Michael at the end. The house burnt down, whatever. Then they bring him back and kills. Whether you're into that movie or not, they do some choices there. And then this one, they just throw out any bit of momentum I feel like they could have had with Halloween Kills. And then just, they're like, yeah, Michael is a side character and he's barely in this movie. And I think that's the problem. But my biggest thing with this is, at the very least, you are giving me a Halloween movie. At least Rob Zombie understood in his movies that you need really memorable kill scenes and you need some characters just getting killed in the most brutal ways possible. You have scenes, even in Halloween 2, a movie I hate, you have the actress that played Jamie in Halloween's 4 and 5. You find her dead in the bathroom with blood all over. And honestly, that scene is effective and at least it's memorable. You don't get any decent kills in this whole movie. This went from the series that had the new doctor of Michael getting his head stomped like a pumpkin in the 2018 version, and you see it all, it doesn't cut away, to in this movie, you have Michael do that to someone exactly the same way. You have him just stomp on someone's head, and as soon as the head and the foot hits the head, it cuts away. This felt like a PG-13 movie that like barely made it to R, and I don't know why they did that. It went straight to streaming plus theaters. Like, you've already done two movies in the franchise. At least have the violence that you brought into the 2018, and even what Halloween Kills included. You had some fun Michael kills in that movie, and that was missing in this. The plot, so you combine a plot I don't care about, you get rid of the characters that you're supposed to be focusing on, and then you don't have a single memorable kill outside of maybe the one DJ guy. You have a decent practical effect there, but even that is played out more like a goofy moment than an actual, you know, scary kill. So I think this one just fails in every possible way that it could. I still like the finale. I think the Jamie Lee Curtis and Michael, once you get them together, works for me. And that's what saved this from being like the worst of the franchise. But it right now ranks as number 12 of 13, only ahead of Halloween 2, Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, which Tristan, I think that's his second of the franchise. So we're differing on that. So I'm very interested to see how we might have differed on this one.
Yeah, you were very intensely negative on Halloween Kills. I really enjoy Halloween Kills for what it is, but that's because for me it's like a throwback to just, let's have Michael Myers kill a bunch of people, this endless slaughter, let's have him kill and kill and kill and kill and kill. And this feels like a different type of throwback. They're trying in a way to do a throwback to Season of the Witch, or to, you know, Friday the 13th 5, where they're doing these, or even like the end of Halloween 4, where they're trying to set up the fact that maybe Michael Myers will like pass on his mantle. Maybe there'll be another person to take on kind of the boogeyman, the shape name on Haddonfield. And I like that concept. And Johnny mentioned that he really was not a fan of the Allison and Corey romance, or Corey as a character in general. And that's the one thing I think we differ on, because I really honestly enjoyed their romance and their relationship. I liked Corey as a character. I didn't necessarily like the actor. I don't know if it was a great performance, but I like what they were going for with the character a bit. I like the setup of him having this weird traumatic experience at the beginning, and like the idea that the town is kind of like corrupting him and turning him into kind of like a different version of himself that he wasn't before this event. And I like those concepts, but I think they don't know how to balance all of these ideas into a good thing. You know, I like the idea of subverting the focus of a Halloween movie and giving us this like instead of being about Michael Myers, have it be about this tragic, toxic romance that was, in a way, created by Michael Myers and is not like the lasting impact of his legacy. But they try to do that, and they also try to do the epic franchise finale thing. You know, they want to have the Laurie Strode Michael Myers epic climax. They want to sell that to the audience, and I think they just can't do both. And I know they wanted to make this be a trilogy and have it be like that nice and neat, but I wouldn't have been opposed to them being like, look, we're going to have this fourth movie that's about Corey and Allison, and Michael Myers is not really in it that much. And then maybe he shows up in the last scene and he pulls some big plot twist, and then we get to the Halloween Ends, then we get to the finale. But I think they tried to do both and they couldn't have done both. And if he wanted to do the big finale, the big climax, just don't put so much time into the Corey stuff. And if you want to do the Corey stuff, you got to follow through with that and make it interesting and make it pay off well, because it just really was not able to do both of those. And I think it ended up being a disservice to all of the plot lines, because the romance doesn't necessarily follow through in any interesting way because they don't have the time for it. And the Laurie's just in the background, not really part of the plot at all, until suddenly she has to show up and be in the finale. Like, it's a bit of a very much a mixed movie that has ideas at the beginning that all just kind of like fall flat for me by the end. And I was ready to love this in the opening sequence. I was ready to like this in the kind of the first act I was kind of into. And then it just fell apart for me. It really did not work for me as a whole entire piece. And it made this whole entire trilogy feel like a bit of a misfire, you know, because I look at it and I wonder, like, what were they doing with this trilogy? What were they going for? Like, Kills is my favorite of the three, but I didn't love Kills. I enjoyed it. It was fun, but it's not something that I'm going to be like watching every year or anything like that. I just look at this whole trilogy and I think, what were you aiming for? What were you trying to say? Because they want us to take this seriously. This is like a serious drama at port, especially at the end, you know, they're like trying to be thematic, but like, what theme is that? What theme is there here? What are you going for with this movie or this whole trilogy?
Evil dies tonight.
Evil does die tonight. You know, that is true.
Yeah, I echo a lot of that. I mean, I obviously wasn't into some of the plots that you were, but yeah, it's when you are trying to throw so many subplots into one movie, none of them pan out. And this just felt like that. You could have done one or two of those stories and made it work. But when you also throw in the dynamic of Laurie losing a relationship with her granddaughter, and then you throw in a love story with Laurie into it, like, you have so many different subplots that just none of them pan out well. The ending could have, if you just focused on that story, I think the ending could have been more effective, especially after, if you were into Halloween Kills with the whole city teams up against this evil force, I think the payoff could be pretty decent by the end of this. But you forget all about that because of everything else going on up until the end, that it doesn't have the same impact as it could have. Halloween is my favorite slasher franchise, but I think the biggest sin of any of these franchises is this is the 13th movie of the franchise. You need 13. We don't have floor 13s at hotels, you know, high-rise buildings, things like that, because the number 13 is so tied around horror and this, you know, this dread. And when you're going into the 13th film, that is why I think they have not been able to do another Friday the 13th, because the next one they do is number 13. You have to nail it, and they just didn't nail it. And that's just something that you can't have. You can't just have 13 potentially be a setup for something else, but then halfway through decide that it's not a setup and we got to end it. You know, you got to take that and you got to do something fun with it, and they don't. But yeah, I mean, check it out if you're into slasher movies. If you're not into the horror franchise or the Halloween franchise, I'd be interested to see. I've seen a lot of people giving this too much credit because it does something new. And it's like, just because a horror franchise does something new doesn't make it good. And every time a horror franchise does something new or different, everyone gives it so much too much credit. And this is another aspect of anyone giving this a positive review in my mind, because it's like, yeah, they tried something new, but that doesn't make it good. We might, you know, quickly, briefly touch on another horror sequel that is on HBO Max later, that or whatever we watched it, I don't even remember, that does something new and did it well. But this one is just further proof that just because you do something new doesn't make your movie work.
All right.
I'm curious to watch it again. I'm glad it's streaming because I'm glad I can go back and check it out again because I would like to give it a second chance and see if any of that stuff pays off. But as of now, I'm not positive on this one.
All right. Anything anyone have to say before I move on to our next thing?
That's all I got. Long enough.
Running a little long here, just trying to do a speed run. Basically, Johnny, I know you watched Vengeance. That's on Peacock as well. That's BJ Novak's movie. It came out a few weeks, months ago. If you just want to give a super quick review on that, recommend it people or tell people to steer clear of it.
Quick review is Vengeance is awesome. It's in my top 10 of the year so far. BJ Novak does a great job directing this movie. It comes in like it's a crime mystery type movie. This dude's basically, this girl dies. The family thinks that it's this guy's long-term girlfriend, and it was basically just a one-night stand, but they get him to come down to Texas, and he's just like, I don't even know why I'm here. And then he wants to make a podcast, like a true crime podcast, about this delusional family who thinks this is a murder, and it's really just some girl who OD'd. But then you get into it, and it takes some fun twists and turns. There's more to the story. But the best thing about it that BJ Novak does is you're going to this small Texas town that is, you know, miles and miles away from any big city you've ever heard of. It would be so easy to go into that movie and just pick every character is what you expect them to be. They're the gun touting, hick Southern person thing. But everyone you meet, you think that's how it's going to start. And then they turn into this completely different character. I think BJ Novak shows character development really well, and he writes his characters really well. It's very funny in a dry sense of humor, and it's just very worthwhile of a watch. So I feel like there's not a ton on Peacock that is super worth checking out, but Vengeance is something that if you have Peacock, watch it and you'll get your money's worth for the month, because it's really well done, it's really well directed, the writing in it is sharp, and it's just so different than what you might expect the story to be going in. So highly recommend. This will be probably in my top 20 by the end of the year. Based on how this year has gone so far, I can't see a ton of movies coming on and surpassing it. So definitely check out Vengeance. BJ Novak, I'm interested to see what he does next, because he's always been a great writer. So it's interesting to see that he's also a really strong director. So excited to see what he does after this.
All right, accidentally went a little bit out of order, so normally we would end with something like Peacock, but I forgot about HBO Max. So I watched the documentary on HBO Max, 38 in the Garden, which is about the whole Linsanity era, and Jeremy Lin focuses on his time, going from a guy sleeping on couches just hoping to be on an NBA roster. Like, I'm on an NBA roster today, but tomorrow I may not be. And he got traded to the Knicks, and then, unfortunately for other people, fortunately for him, a few people ahead of him on the depth chart got injured and he got to play, and that's when the whole run started. It's a very short documentary, just like the title, 38 in the Garden, which is a reference to how many points he scored in Madison Square Garden. It's 38 minutes long, super quick watch. Honestly, I think if you're a sports fan or if you were around during the Linsanity era and you remember that, I think it's worthwhile to check out. If you're not really a basketball fan, not really a sports fan, I don't really think this is going to be like some great documentary that's going to interest you or cater to you or anything that you really care about. I definitely feel like it's more for people who watch basketball or NBA fans, or just remember kind of that Linsanity era and want to hear a little bit more of behind the scenes about it, like what Jeremy Lin's thought process was at that time. And also, interesting. Yeah. And also we have... you guys both watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Running a little long on time, if you just want to give kind of your quick thoughts, review, whatever you want to.
Yeah, I'll give a quick thought. You talked about sequels swinging for the fences. This one swings for the next park on the other side of the town. Like, this one goes for the totally different tone, totally different feel. Absolutely goes for like a comedic, dark comedy blast. And the first movie is very gritty and very dark, but it has tiny moments of humor, even just like dark shock humor, in some of the family members' behavior. And this leads into the antics of that a lot. You really spend a lot of time with the family, a lot of time with Leatherface, and kind of getting into the craziness of those characters. But I think this also has some level of thought to it too. It's not just about the craziness. There's a social commentary to it. There's a lot of anger about like the way that media portrays certain groups of people and the way that like certain parts of the country, similar to the first movie, it feels like it's set about in a way that certain parts of the country are like forgotten and left out to the ruin, and like that about like that kind of like underbelly of the society kind of running up and taking the privileged people of normal society into their midst. And this has so much of that. It's very gonzo, very crazy. If you're looking for the perfect Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequel, this isn't the exact same thing done again. This is a different premise. It's actually kind of focused on the detective who's kind of hunting them down, trying to capture the family at the last second, and you're following him. He's played by,
Dennis Hopper.
Dennis Hopper plays the lieutenant of this, and he, a great lead performance. Really fun, crazy gonzo sequel. So yeah, if you want something that goes for the fences, goes for the crazy, and has a real, real crazy ending too, check out Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, directed by the same person who did the first one. So it's not like they handed it off to some like B-movie director. It's handed it off to the B-movie director who made the first one. So if you want to see a crazy sequel by the same guy who made the first one, check it out.
All right, Johnny, any quick thoughts on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2?
Yeah, Tobe Hooper, you know, directed probably one of the greatest slasher movies, if not the greatest slasher movies, which came out about 13 years before this did. And it is pretty straightforward. You get some antics, and especially in the beginning when they pick up a hitchhiker. But in this, he's smart enough to know you can't just make the same movie again. You have to delve into the lore, and I think that's what this really does well. So while feeling like a completely different tone for a lot of it than the original, you get more of the lore of the characters and the family of Bubba and his brothers, you know, for the Texas Chainsaw. So I really had a lot of fun with this. Dennis Hopper running around with chainsaws, it totally throws out logic. It's a lot of, you know, the detective thinks these people use chainsaws, so I'm gonna use chainsaws. Like, there's so much just craziness in this. It's very, you know, it's two different horror movies. You get one that is very 70s, you know, end of the 60s era into the 70s. You get that very serious slasher film, and then the sequel takes on full 80s eccentricism and craziness, and that is what this one does well. So it brings that 80s energy into this franchise, and I can't believe I had never watched this full movie before. As I was watching it, I realized I have definitely seen scenes from it, whether it's been checking out on TV before or probably seeing countdown lists where they have certain scenes, like the one with Grandpa with the hammer. But there's a lot of this movie that's just so much fun. And I really loved Carolyn Williams, the lead in this movie. I thought she was one of the best, you know, if you want to call them scream queens, if you want to call the final girl, whatever. She is awesome in this movie, and I just had a blast with it. Dennis Hopper goes full unhinged, and you know, it's fun to see the character that you're rooting for to take down the bad guys be totally just as unhinged as the villains that he's chasing down. So you basically get this one girl who is the only like human being, and then everyone else around her is this extreme psycho. So it was super fun. Highly recommended if you like dark comedies, if you like horror. I think this has something for everyone. One of my favorite horror sequels ever outside of Exorcist 3, which Tristan introduced me to. I think this might be my second favorite horror sequel.
All right, and that wraps up our discussion on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. No House of the Dragon talk this week. Finale is next week. Tristan and I, and we'll be breaking it down on our episode next week.
And we were actually thinking if we could possibly line up the schedule of doing a special episode of Nothing But House of the Dragon on top of our normal Hand episode. So if you're a big Hot D fan, you might get double the Hand, yeah. Double the Hand this week. You got an episode coming out, all House of the Dragon. If we can get that to work out, I'd hope to do that. That'd be fun.
Yeah, that definitely would be fun. With that moves on to Apple TV Plus, a platform that Tristan fully supports and stands behind. Tristan, kind of, you want to give us a breakdown on your thoughts on Apple TV Plus this week?
Look, you know, I opened up Apple TV, and it was like, oh, you got to sign on again to log into your TV. You got logged out. And I went, and I was like, do I care enough about Apple TV to sign in again? And I was like, I do not. So I went on, and I canceled my Apple TV, so I don't have it anymore, unfortunately. You know, You get one or two shows a year that are good. I'll wait until Ted Lasso comes back, you know, or Servant or Severance, you know. Give me one of your couple of good shows and I'll be back, Apple. But you know what? You lost my $5 because you made me log out and log back in. And I was like, you know what? No, I'm not logging back in. I'm canceling. So see you, see you, Apple.
That's currently what it's doing to me. And I honestly am probably going to do the same thing. There's not enough on this network to make it worth watching. Watch Cha-Cha Real Smooth if you haven't, if you have Apple Plus, and watch whatever shows Tristan was talking about and cancel it. Because, yeah, and Tragedy of Macbeth, which I wasn't super into, but is a really well-made film. But yeah, there's not enough on that as a streamer. Once Apple buys a couple of these other ones, maybe there's going to be enough on there. But as far as now, there's not enough stuff on there.
All right, I think that kind of wraps up the review portion of the show. Really, the only thing we have left now, we've kind of changed around some things we used to do, like what's leaving streaming, but we're kind of just leaving that more towards the end of the month. And also our winner of the week, which we are changing to the winner of the month, and that is what we feel is the best streaming service that month. And so that leaves us just to our MVP. I don't know if either of you guys have your MVP thoughts. I will give my first nomination, and I know I'm the only person that picked this person because I'm the only one that watched it. And my MVP for this week is Matt Whitecross, the director for the Sound of 007 documentary. I just think the fact that they have all of these people, all of these musicians, you know, Billie Eilish, Duran Duran, Jack White, the directors of the various Bond movies, the, you know, the people that worked on the sound, Barbara Broccoli appears in it and gives an interview, finding this archival footage of John Barry. I just think everything about this documentary, well made, kind of a lighter week. No one really stood out to me hardcore. So when I sat and thought about it, who do I think gave the best performance this weekend for me? It's Matt Whitecross, the director of The Sound of 007. And I will go to Tristan for his thoughts on who he wants to nominate for MVP of the week.
For my nomination, it's easy to take just this week, but I feel like I've got to give her the nomination for a handful of weeks. We haven't talked about She-Hulk until now, but Tatiana Maslany is the lifeblood of She-Hulk. I feel like her performance, even in some of the weaker storylines, is a lot of fun. And her energy and her comedic timing gave the energy that the show needed for so much of its runtime, especially in that last episode. You know, they do a lot of meta stuff, a lot of big stuff, and with a weaker performance, I don't know if that sells well. And I think Tatiana Maslany, for the entirety run of She-Hulk, but also just for this finale, I feel like I'm going to get her my MVP nomination.
All right. And Johnny, have you thought of anybody? Any ideas come to mind who your MVP of the week is?
As far as MVP of the week, in terms of like actually MVP, I'd honestly go with Fede Alvarez, who is a director I'm not like a super big fan of. He did the Evil Dead remake and he did Don't Breathe, which I think are fine, but he has really great insight on the 101 scariest horror movie moment show that I was talking about with Shudder. Every time it cuts to him, I'm really interested in what he has to say, and he's on there a decent amount. So my MVP is the one show that I've checked out from this week, which would be that. And he's probably my favorite talking head that we cut to on that show. As much as I love Mike Flanagan and some of the other people on there, I think Fede Alvarez has a really interesting perspective on horror films. So it was fun to hear from him. So that would be my only choice, other than the kid who gets pushed off the railing at the beginning of Halloween Ends, because it was super funny. That was a laugh out loud moment. That was my favorite moment of the movie.
I laughed and I realized nobody in the theater laughed except for me, and I was just like, oh.
I was in my bed at home watching it and I burst out laughing. If I was in the theater, I would have laughed. Oh, what a moment.
All right, so it could be a little bit more challenging. Normally our MVP pick is something Tristan and I have both watched, so it's like, oh yeah, that's a great pick, yeah, I'll go with that. Or, oh okay, it's, we're debating between two things both of us watch. So now we have my pick is something that you two haven't watched, and then Johnny's pick is something neither of us. I've watched She-Hulk. I think Tatiana Maslany's good. I think it's a worthy MVP pick. I just think there's, like, I would almost say the writing team of She-Hulk would be more carries that show. I think Tatiana Maslany. Does anyone hear what anyone else said and be like, oh, that's a solid choice for a vote?
Let's say, as someone who is coming in new to the show, I will vote on it. And while, you know, Joe's picking someone James Bond. That's totally up my alley. For everyone I saw on Twitter complaining about the twerking on She-Hulk, I vote with Tristan. I vote Tatiana Maslany.
Okay.
I have not watched a second of the show, and I love James Bond, but I think everything that I've actually seen her in, I really enjoy her in, and she's the only reason that I've even considered watching She-Hulk is because I'm a fan. And everyone outraged on Twitter when she had Megan Thee Stallion on there. So I vote with Tristan, but that will probably completely change when I never watch that show ever. And on what's next month, November 1st, I watch The Sound of Bond and probably side with Joe. But I vote. Yeah, I vote. Tristan.
I'm okay.
5 years, Johnny will text us and be like, you know what? You were right. Tatiana Maslany, MVP of the week. You called it.
All right, I'm good with that. I think she did a very good job on the show. And who knows how much actually of getting the talent doing all that Matt Whitecross did for the documentary. I was just like, that documentary.
Tough to say.
That documentary was the best thing I watched all week, so I'll just give the documentary of it MVP. So with that, our MVP of the week of The Hand Plus is Tatiana Maslany of She-Hulk.
Go watch Orphan Black.
So far,
yeah,
of all of She-Hulk. all of our MVP votes have gone to either HBO Max or Disney Plus. So hopefully, one of these other streaming services will step up and give us another MVP worthy candidate.
Come on, guys, you're so close.
And what are you doing? Netflix isn't that close.
And with that, does anyone have anything to say before we end our show?
Watch The Exorcist 3 and watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Happy Halloween.
All right, yeah. Next week we will be discussing maybe the next episode of Andor. We'll see how that goes. And probably a little bit more catch-up on just the things we missed. There's a show on Peacock that looks interesting to me, a true crime show. So we will see where it goes. But
let us know what you're streaming on Halloween. Yeah. We'd love to hear what you're watching this week. Yeah. When you come back, it'll be, I think, either on or like right after Halloween. So... let us know what you watched this week. Yeah.
Well, we got one more episode. We got an episode that's going to be the 24th, and then we have an episode that's Halloween Day. So we got two more episodes.
Oh, perfect.
We got two more episodes this month. If there's something that you think we should be watching and talk about that we haven't mentioned, tweet at us, message us on Instagram, you know, whatever, at Movie Change Up, and talk to the hand. And without further ado, goodbye. Hey, thank you for watching the Movie Change Up podcast. We'd really appreciate if you liked, commented, subscribed, and shared us with anyone you think might be into what we're doing over here. Thank you. Have a nice day.